Everyone, thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. It's July 2018, and you're listening to episode 81 of Postmodern Realities, and I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Paul Chamberlain, who is director of the Institute for Christian Apologetics at Trinity Western University in Canada, and has taught ethics, philosophy of religion, and Christian apologetics there since 1990. He is also the author of several books. In the 2018 Volume 41, Number 4 issue of the Christian Research Journal, Paul has written a feature article called Why People Stop Believing, which is also based on his book by the same name. Paul, it's good to have you on.
Thank you, Melanie. Great to be here.
So this article talks about people who, you know, and specific Christians who used to believe in Christianity and then have renounced the faith. And it's a little bit different, not just your, you know, average Christian, quote unquote, in the pew, but more intellectuals, professors, and those kinds of people. And so what in your experience motivated you to research this particular topic about those types of people in specific who renounce Christianity?
Well, that's a really great question, because I did a lot of soul searching on that very thing. But it really all began a number of years back with a conversation with a good friend of mine who had a colleague at work. My friend was raised in a Christian home, a really solid guy. He had actually attended a Bible college. He was now a professional working in his field and very active in his church and all those things. And he had a colleague at work who used to be a part of the Christian community. Then he walked away. He had done his own research, his own study, and my friend wanted to talk with him. And here they had an opportunity to get away and go for a weekend to work on this project together. So he said, "Here's my chance." He went out there and he began asking him some questions, and it did not go well. For everything my friend said, this other colleague of his had very quick answers, and many of those were answers and issues my friend had not heard. When he got all done with everything he had to say, his friend started in with an entire litany of objections and challenges, contradictions in the Gospels. What do we know about Jesus in the first place? He went on and on and on. In fact, I got my friend to send me an email, just a long list of things he raised. And my friend was simply totally unprepared for this. He came back actually with a faith crisis. We got a phone call from him and his wife saying, "Hey, this is not go well." Well, I shared that with a pastor friend of mine, and he came back to me 6 months later and said, "You remember that story you told me? That still gives me the willies." He says, "I'm just thinking about the people in my church, and I just wonder how would they do any better, even with all the teaching I think I'm giving them." And then the idea hit me. As I looked around, I began to see others who were leaders in the churches, either academic leaders or pastors, leaders in academic institutions, master's degrees, theologians, the whole thing, who were once part of the Christian community, worshiped right alongside the rest of us, and now they'd renounced the faith. And I thought, we have a new kind of critic here, very passionate, very well-informed, and also receiving a great level of credibility from our culture, because who would know the faith better than they? They were once in it. And I just began to realize, and in fact, my pastor friend said, "This has got to be something you write on in the near future." And other people in Christian leadership encouraged me to do the same thing. So that's what got me started, and it opened up a whole new world. Some people I've debated, some I've known in the past and studied with, they were now they're out there renouncing Christianity and debunking the faith, and it really, really did get my attention.
I know of someone actually, and he's maybe in his 40s, and he has a podcast as a former pastor and missionary, and it's really highly popular. I don't want to name that podcast because it'll just give them more promotion, but it's extremely popular. And because he's on, you know, the younger side, maybe late 30s, that early 40s type of thing, he just has this kind of cultural cred, so to speak, where he just talks about all these different things because he had spent so many years on the mission field and in the pastorate. So I just want to ask you, why do these particular types of people stop believing? You know, you mentioned different people who once taught at maybe the university level, you know, Christian theological classes, or, you know, we mentioned pastors or people who've gone to seminary and theologians, those kinds of people. Why do they stop believing?
Well, I tell you, that's a very hard question. At first, I didn't think there was going to be any good answer to it because I saw so many different stories. And I thought, how do we categorize these people? There's no really easy way. But then I began to find a few patterns emerging in certain things that were true of a good number of people. Things like personal disappointment with Christians, with the church, ultimately leading to disappointment with God himself. Sometimes a personal failure coupled with difficulties finding acceptance. If you've had a personal failure, you come back to your people and your church and you hope for acceptance and you hope for grace and forgiveness. And sometimes you're treated, they treat you differently. They doubt your word. They treat you like damaged goods, something like that. In other cases, there's just what I call unrealistic expectations from God, from the Christian faith. One pastor who's on the internet right now says, I just simply ran out of excuses for God. He says, as a pastor, I believed and I taught others too, that God would do things like answer our prayers and he would protect people from others, and he would give us wisdom and strength, and he would provide healing from our diseases and provide an abundance of the things we need and things like that. He says, and over time, I just had so many disappointments. He says, then came the excuses, what he called the fine point of his theology. And he says, after a while, he just said, forget it. I ran out of excuses. I walked away. And then, of course, there's intellectual difficulties as well. Some people just run into things, issues about the character of God, the existence of God, biblical morality, the God of the Old Testament, the reliability of the New Testament, supernaturalism versus naturalism, things like this. These are all issues that are raised by people who they said they simply couldn't find any solutions for. But there's also, this is a bit of a long answer, Melody, sorry, but the one issue that I found resonating across the field of those who leave is their claim that they had a desire to carry out honest, rational inquiry and thinking, and the perception that Christianity inhibits or restricts this. I'd be very surprised if the person you're talking about didn't raise this exact point repeatedly. I was involved in an atheist convention myself some time back. And when I got up there, I was wondering, I said the same thing a lot of my friends were wondering, why do atheists get together? What do they have to celebrate? And when I got there, I found the answer is very, very obvious. They were all X this or X that, X somethings, the ones at this conference, hundreds of them from all over North America. I was involved in a kickoff, as a dialogue debate at the beginning of the conference. And what they were celebrating was their freedom to study and to inquire and to think. And their charge about Christianity is that while Christians may say they follow evidence and they value evidence and reason, at the end of the day, their views all must conform to the Bible. So if the evidence they find supports that book, well, then great. But if not, then so much worse for the evidence. And they said, if you want to be honest, you want to really think and be rational and be clear, you got to get out. This resonates across the board with many, many people who have left, especially the type of thinking person. And you can see it in the testimonials on the websites. You can see it in the groups and the organizations they form, groups like with names like Free Thought Society and Project Reason and the Center for Inquiry and things like that. The idea is if you want to be free to think for yourself, free from all these restrictions, you got to get out. So I've devoted a chapter in the book to that exact issue because it's such a big one.
Well, I mentioned a particular story of somebody I actually know who has renounced Christ and who was a pastor. But do you have any other stories of similar people that you can share with us?
Well, yeah. One was a colleague of mine. This is one that stands out in my mind all the time. He was a colleague of mine. We were doing our PhD studies together. And actually, as it turned out, we had graduated from the same theological seminary as well. I was a little earlier than him. He was just a tiny bit younger than I am. And he had come a bit later, but he had graduated from a second with two master's degrees from two different evangelical schools, a very bright guy. In fact, I myself used to ask him tough questions about the Bible, about Christian faith. I still remember having conversations like that. And I thought his answers were some of the best I'd heard. And then as time went on, something happened. Suddenly I realized he wasn't in our program anymore. He was gone. And I found out later he had encountered some serious personal difficulties. Some of them were of his own making, but he went through some real deep waters. He still clung to the faith for a number of years, doing some preaching, some board member work, etc. But over time, as he says now, he began to doubt the things he believed for over two decades. Things he used to find convincing, he didn't find convincing anymore. He ended up being involved in a divorce, remarrying. And today he's devoted his entire life to debunking Christianity. He's written, edited a number of books on this. And I have to say, this is some of the hardest hitting stuff I've ever read because he is a very, very bright guy, as I say. And he knows things from the other side. When he writes things against Christianity, he understands full well what the typical response is probably going to be, and he's already got that included in his writings. That's just one. Another example is a man I debated. I wasn't aware of this until I actually just I got to know him a little bit before the debate. But he had been a Southern Baptist from the United States down in the South, studying, preparing for ministry. And the more he studied, the more he began to doubt, he says, and he couldn't find answers. And he felt his faith was restricting this process. And so eventually he looked into philosophical writings and as time went on, made the decision to throw off what he calls the shackles of religion. This is a term he uses again and again and again. Really, really nice guy. He now leads the atheist community in Austin, Texas. As nice a guy as you'll ever meet. In fact, I have an open invitation to come down and see him and have a real good steak down there and stay in his guest room. So if I get a chance to do that, I'm going to do it. But he's quite prominent on the internet. But here he went from preparing for ministry to now spending his entire life speaking against Christian faith. He's on the internet. He speaks all over the place. Pretty good speaker. Super nice guy. Those are just two stories, Melanie.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Paul Chamberlain, and in the 2018 Volume 41, Number 4 issue of the Christian Research Journal, Paul has written a feature article called Why People Stop Believing. Also in this issue, you will not want to miss out on reading our article about training teens in apologetics and our evaluation of the HBO series Westworld, as well as our feature about the historical uniqueness of Jesus Christ among the founders of the world's major religions, written by Gary Habermas. In addition, if you'd like to partner with the Christian Research Institute, we'd like to send you, for your gift of any amount, a copy of Paul's book for the month of July 2018, and that book is Why People Stop Believing, and we're discussing his book today and his article on this podcast. Please go to equip.org. And we'd like you to subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is now at a new lower price of $33.50. And you can also subscribe online at equip.org. You know, those are really kind of just, I guess, sad stories that you were just sharing with us a few moments ago, to see people, like you were saying, who are perfectly really nice and kind, engaging people, like that Baptist pastor in Texas who has now renounced his faith. You mention in this article that these kind of critics of Christianity, like this former Baptist pastor, are kind of a new critic. And you specifically use the term that they're changing the face of atheism. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Well, yes, that is an interesting term that I did develop over time. Mentally, what I discovered, and I discovered this through some interaction with a number of atheists that I interacted with, is that there has been a real significant shift in the way atheism is being presented and argued for by a fair number of atheists today. It's something that I experienced, as I say, through interacting with them. But a key part of this is the shifting of the burden of proof fully and completely over to the theist. In other words, and rather than now argue that atheism is true, just often it's conceded right up front. And in fact, I've sometimes been amazed at just how easily and quickly this is conceded, that there's no way they can prove that. Rather, the atheist will spend the entire time giving arguments to try to show that there is no burden of proof on the atheist to make any arguments at all. That's your job as a theist. For some of the arguments used for making this case, in other words, that the burden of proof is on the theist alone, not the atheist, are fairly ingenious. But in the process of making this argument, it often gets even a bit thicker, because sometimes the very definition of atheism is changed. It becomes blurred, almost indistinguishable from agnosticism. And this can really be confusing and kind of frustrating. But it's also a very powerful tool if it succeeds, because this kind of move can entirely rewrite the rules of discussion entirely. In other words, if it's accepted that the burden of proof really does belong solely with the theist, then the atheist's job is really very simple. No need to work on any arguments. Just sit back, listen to the arguments from the theist, and then say, I just don't find those convincing. I remember having an interaction with one atheist, and he had made this point repeatedly. And I finally said to him in the cross-examination, I said, are you telling us today that the burden of proof is always and exclusively on the person making a positive truth claim? In other words, God exist, rather than a negative claim like God does not exist? And he said, yes. And I gave him a couple of examples. And eventually it came down to this. He said, my position really is not that I believe there is no God. My position is just that I don't believe there is a God. And he said, if I made the first statement, I believe there is no God, well, then I would have a burden of proof, but that is not my claim. My claim is I just don't believe there is no God, that there is a God. Now, that is really quite an ingenious move, but it means we really have to ask some good questions about this, because if that's the case, then the position is almost indistinguishable from atheism, and we need to be very clear on how we respond to that. I have a chapter in the book on that topic as well, because it is such a pressing topic.
Earlier, you were talking about various different reasons why some of these people have left the faith. And one of the things that you briefly mentioned that I'd like you to unpack a little bit more is the critique that they give that Christianity has this restriction on the freedom to reason, and that limits a person's freedom to think for themselves. So can you please explain that a little bit more and unpack that criticism that they claim?
Yes, that is a really key argument, a criticism. I find it resonates across the entire field of these folks who have left the faith and are now atheists. The perception is that Christianity inhibits or restricts honest, rational inquiry thinking. And the charge is just this, that they will say to you and to me, Melanie, that Christians will say, they may say they value or follow evidence and reason, but at the end of the day, their views must conform to the Bible, to this holy book. And that holy book is given to the Christians in advance of their study, in advance of any evidence they see. So in other words, if the evidence supports the book, well, then great. But if not, then so much worse for the evidence. And the idea is that if you want to really be free to think and reason for yourself and not be told what to think, then you've got to get out of Christianity and probably all religion. And then you'll be free to think for yourself. And you can see this in the testimonials you find on various websites where people will talk about having been freed from the shackles, the structures of religion. You'll see this in the names of the organizations that either start or they join, some called with names like Free Thought Society, Project Reason, the Center for Inquiry, that idea. And this really does require some good, careful thinking on our part. I think there are some wonderful responses to this, by the way. But this is something that resonates across the board with many, many people who have walked away from the faith.
Well, something that you talk about in your book that you don't really unpack in your article is that you spend a lot of time in the book on the reliability of the New Testament. So how can you summarize the case that we can trust what the New Testament really said?
Well, that's a great point, because this is exactly one area where people who walk away from the faith have trouble. What I discovered, and there's usually three points I like to get across. The first is that the early Christian community established some very rigorous criteria. They went to great lengths to ensure that only the most trustworthy documents were regarded as authoritative and to be included in the canon of Scripture. The two criteria really were earliness and connection to the original apostles. The documents had to be early. They had to have a connection with the early original apostles. And of course, Matthew and John were original apostles. Mark and Luke had connections with them. And these criteria became well known enough that when others who wrote spurious documents wanted to have them included, they had a simple technique: simply put the name of one of the original apostles on the document and pass it off as one of those. So you see spurious documents with names like the Gospel of Peter or the Acts of Paul or the Gospel of Judas even. But the result of that is, and this is the second point, that we end up with four independent sources of the life and teaching carefully and rigorously examined by the early Christians to make sure they met these two criteria, which means we have these documents written by people with connections to the earliest apostles, people who spent 3 years with Jesus. They heard him give the same teachings over and over, watched him answer people's questions, etc. And of course, the third point I like to often raise deals with the discrepancies in details, because these are often raised, contradictions among the synoptics, for example. What I discovered through my research on this book, something I had a hint of before, but I learned in a much fuller way through writing this book, was that discrepancies in the details in the synoptics are not a bad thing. They're a good thing. When historians discover them in multiple sources on other issues, it's an indication of credibility, because it shows the documents are not the result of collusion, of people getting their story straight. And you see this in police detective work. You see this in the work of historians. I like the way N.T. Wright says it. He said, "The differences in details, along with the core events being consistent, are exactly what you would expect from eyewitness testimony of people who were experiencing something that was very different from what they would have expected, very different from their worldview." That's how he puts it. And I came away with a much stronger confidence that we are a very fortunate people, a blessed people, really, to have these four independent documents written by people who were close to Jesus.
Well, you also maintain that even if we don't know who the authors of the Gospels are, it doesn't really diminish their reliability. And that sounds counterintuitive to most people. So how can you explain that so people can be equipped to really answer that?
Yeah, that's interesting. That did sound counterintuitive to me when I first heard it as well. It's kind of an odd idea, isn't it? But the reason I included this point in there was that certain critics of the New Testament, and you're probably well aware of this, Melody, argue that we just don't know who wrote the Gospels. Their contention is that the names that are attached there to these Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were probably put there later by the early Christian community. And this is taken to be a strike against their historical trustworthiness. So I thought to myself, well, having looked at the issue, I began to think to myself and to believe that there are really are some pretty solid reasons for thinking that these Gospels really were written by their traditional authors. But I thought, let's just take the worst case scenario and just ask, what if we really don't know? Does that mean that the reliability of the Gospels are immediately called into question? And the answer is no, not necessarily, because technically questions of authorship and reliability are two different entities, and a challenge to one is not necessarily the result in a challenge to the other. And the clearest example I saw right off the bat was the book of Hebrews. We really don't know who wrote the book of Hebrews. It might have been Paul. People used to say that more. It might have been Apollos, the debater in the Gospels, the book of Acts, I should say. It may have been Priscilla, a friend, associate of Paul, a woman who would not have attached her name. We just don't know. But very few people doubt the historical credibility of the book of Hebrews for that reason. And I believe it is helpful to know, but even if we don't, it struck me that there are other indicators, other criteria of credibility that are still there that can still be examined, like the likely dating of the document, the criteria of dissimilarity, embarrassment, multiple attestation. These are sort of technical terms, but these are all criteria that can be applied to a book, even if we don't know who wrote the book, to determine whether it does give us a credible, trustworthy portrayal of the events it describes.
Well, one of the points that you make in your article about why some of these Christians who are intellectuals stop believing, and, you know, former professors and those kinds of things, has to do with naturalism. In other words, in the 21st century, because of science, you know, we can't believe in this mumbo jumbo and miracles and so forth. And so you kind of make the case that naturalism is really a stumbling block for many of these people. And so can you explain for our listeners, first of all, what is naturalism and how does it undermine Christianity?
Well, naturalism is the assumption that there is no supernatural realm. There is no God. Nature is all there is. And therefore, miracles cannot, will not occur, because there is simply no supernatural being out there who might from time to time choose to intervene in our world and bring about a miracle. Now, as you say, the fact is this kind of naturalism is quite deeply embedded in the thinking of most Westerners, most North Americans, including many of us Christians, if we really examine. When you and I hear the story of a miracle, probably our tendency is to exhaust every naturalistic explanation, even those of us who are Christians and who believe in the supernatural realm. We exhaust all the natural possibilities, explanations, before concluding it could be a miracle. But you see, scholars like R.G. Swinburne, R.T. France, people like that, have made the statement that the most foundational reason many people end up judging the New Testament to be unreliable has nothing to do with its trustworthiness as a historical document, but rather it concerns the presence of miracles and the supernatural in it. And you can see that, because when the naturalist would hear the report of a miracle, really, that person will simply be unable to accept that a miracle really occurred. Really, any alternative explanation will be preferable, even if it is one that just says, I don't have an explanation for that at the moment, but perhaps we'll get one later. But your question was, how does it undermine Christianity? Well, in a nutshell, this kind of naturalism is lethal to Christianity, because if miracles really do not occur, if a person simply can't accept that miracles occur, then they will never be able to accept the foundational miracle of Christianity, that Jesus rose from the dead, 1 Corinthians chapter 15. But even beyond that, if a naturalistic outlook is driving the way a person interprets the New Testament documents, then you'll end up having to negate and throw out many key parts of the New Testament. Take a whole different view of who Jesus is. He's going to end up being a purely human person, not the divine Son of God, etc. So it seems to me that this kind of what we often call philosophical naturalism, which, by the way, I distinguish from what's often called methodological naturalism, so just the practice of scientists when they do their scientific work, without making no comment on whether or not there's a God out there or not. This kind of philosophical, sometimes called metaphysical naturalism, will end up being lethal to Christianity. And so it really bears our discussion of it.
I agree with you. I think even for Christians, you know, we put things into two categories. I've talked about that before in this podcast. You know, things that we think are like in science and factual, and then everything else that could be like feelings and prayer and miracles and all those kinds of things. And it just shows you how much, you know, this kind of naturalistic thinking has even really crept into our own worldview about what, you know, the way we even consider things, whether they'd be true or not, or whether they could happen or not, based on those two different categories that we have in our minds. So given that, how is it possible today in 2018 to even believe in the kind of miracles that the New Testament describes, from obviously the biggest one that our faith is hinged on, which is the resurrection of Jesus Christ, or any of the other miracles that he did to, you know, show that he was the Son of God?
Right. And you know what, Melody, I think it is hard. I think it is difficult for some people, perhaps for most of us in the 20th century, to believe in miracles. We just haven't really been raised that way. We haven't been schooled that way by our culture, especially the type of miracles that the New Testament describes. But the fact that it's hard for us to believe in them is not because a miracle could not happen. It's simply, as I said, a cultural leaning, a cultural presupposition that really pervades our thinking and our culture. And it's not even always necessarily a bad thing, but it is a reality. But the fact remains, when we ask how is it possible for a person to believe in kind of miracles that we're talking about, the fact remains that if God is possible, this is the point I just make repeatedly anywhere I go, if God is even possible, then miracles are also possible, at least possible, which means that the only way to really defend naturalism, the only way to rule out the existence of the possibility of a miracle having occurred, is to have an airtight argument for atheism. And that's very, very difficult to come by. As R.G. Swinburne makes this point very well in a book he has written called Resurrection of God Incarnate. He makes a really great point there. Where he says it's at least logically possible that the way things behave depends upon a God who stands behind the universe. If that's even logically possible, it's also logically possible that a miracle will occur, which means that no matter who you are, naturalist or not, when you hear the report of a miracle, you really are on shaky ground by just ruling it out and saying, I know that could not have happened. The only way to do that is to have an airtight argument for atheism. And as I say, that's very difficult to come by.
Well, just our conversation today might have left some of our listeners feeling a bit discouraged and overwhelmed. I mean, all these people who were, you know, even if we think of somebody like a big name like Bart Ehrman, who teaches at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, who went to Christian college and now is, you know, refutes Christianity. I mean, we can start getting super discouraged. I mean, especially you told some of those stories, and I told a story of somebody I know who has a well-regarded podcast who tries to refute Christianity. It's going to leave us somewhat discouraged. So was there anything encouraging at all for you as you did this project that, you know, made you feel encouraged about the gospel and the state of the Christian church and the growth of the church?
Well, I will say that when I began this project, I was realizing I was embarking on probably the most serious project I ever had embarked on. And as I worked through it, began working through material, and as I presented it to people in different lecture format and different informal formats as well, I have been very encouraged by two things here. The first is by the deep level of interest this issue has raised with people I talk to. I find people are very interested. They're deeply concerned about the issue. They're really wanting to address it. You can sometimes hear a pin drop as you tell some of the stories, like the one you told and the couple I told and maybe some others as well. And usually there are people there who are interested, who that maybe they have children or they have brothers or sisters or some good friend who has turned away. There's often some grief and some questioning associated with that, like what could I have done differently? And suffice it to say, these folks are the most affirming, the most encouraging. They have the most heartfelt comments. But that to tell you the truth, that's actually been quite encouraging to me. But the other thing is this, the other point for encouragement for me is that my confidence in the truth of the Christian gospel has been bolstered through the research I plowed through in writing the book. I have just come away, as referring back to the previous question, I've come away with a real confidence that we are a very fortunate people to have these four independent sources of the life and teaching of Jesus written by people with connections to the earliest apostles. They spent time with him. They could ask him questions. They could watch how he dealt with people. They could debrief later. They were in such an excellent position to give us a credible information about Jesus. And as I read those gospels now, I read them with even greater confidence than I did before I began the project. So those are areas that I have found deeply encouraging.
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid-fire questions for Paul. So, Paul, it's summer. Would you rather eat ice cream, frozen yogurt, or drink a smoothie?
Ice cream all the way.
Are you an introvert or extrovert?
Well, actually, I'm kind of right in the middle on that. I'm more introverted than some people think because I do public speaking, but I am right in the middle, maybe tending toward the introvert side.
So, call or text? Which do you prefer?
Call.
And are you an early bird or a night owl?
You know what? It's going to sound funny, but I'm really a moderate on both those. I'm not too bad in the morning, but I'm a lot better in the evening than my wife is. Let's put it that way.
Well, thanks, Paul, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
You're most welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Today's guest is Paul Chamberlain, and in the 2018 Volume 41, Number 4 issue of the Christian Research Journal, Paul has written a feature article called Why People Stop Believing, based on the book that he wrote by the same name. To read his evangelism article, please subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is now at a new lower price of $33.50, and to subscribe online, visit equip.org, and when you subscribe, it helps continue this podcast that we bring you free of charge. And if you'd like to partner with the Christian Research Institute this month in July 2018, please go to equip.org, and for your gift of any amount, we'll send you a copy of Paul's book, Why People Stop Believing. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. Follow the Bible Answer Man on Instagram, and please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes. And when you rate and review our podcast, it helps others to find our content. So please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged. It's Hank's new audio podcast. You'll follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.